Senator Bush reported in his October 9th memorandum to James Brian Conant. The archives divulge no smoking gun. The closest the records come to a piece of paper that changed the world is a banality. Bush personally delivered the Third National Academy of Sciences report to the president on November 27, 1941. Roosevelt returned it to him 2 months later with a note on White House stationery written in black ink with a broad-nibbed pen, a note that would communicate only a commonplace of the housekeeping of state secrets, except for the authority of its first vernacular expression and the initials it bears. Text reads, January 19th, VB. Okay, returned. I think you had best keep this in your own safe. FDR. Still orphaned was plutonium, which Lawrence and Compton believed so promising. Compton found his chance to speak for it in early December when Bush and Conant called the members of the Uranium Committee to Washington to announce the reorganization of their work. Harold Urey would develop gaseous diffusion at Columbia, Bush and Conant had decided. Lawrence would pursue electromagnetic separation at Berkeley. A young chemical engineer, Eager V. Murfree, the director of research for Standard Oil of New Jersey, would supervise centrifuge development and look into broader questions of engineering. Compton, in Chicago, would be responsible for theoretical studies and the actual design of the bomb. The meeting adjourned, writes Compton, with the understanding that we would meet again in 2 weeks to compare progress and shape our plans more firmly. Bush, Conant, and Compton went to lunch at the Cosmos Club on Lafayette Square. There, the Chicago physicist spoke up for plutonium. He argued that the advantage of chemical extraction rather than isotope separation made Element 94 a worthy competitor. Bush was wary. Conant pointed out that the new element's chemistry was still largely unknown. Compton recalls their exchange. Seaborg tells me that within 6 months from the time plutonium is formed by chain reaction, he can have it available for use in the bomb, was my comment. Glenn Seaborg is a very competent young chemist. But he isn't that good, said Conant. How good a chemist Glenn Seaborg might be remained to be seen. Compton, Conant remembers, went on to argue that the construction of a self-sustaining chain reaction in natural uranium, Fermi and Szilard's project, would be a magnificent achievement. Even if plutonium flunked as bomb material, it would prove that the measurements and theoretical calculations were correct. I never knew whether it was this near certainty of demonstrating a slow neutron reaction which settled the matter in Van's mind, or whether he was impressed with Compton's faith in the production of a plutonium bomb, against my lack of faith as a chemist. At all events, within a matter of weeks, he agreed to Arthur Compton setting up at Chicago a highly secret project. Bush had called the Washington meeting on a weekend to accommodate busy men. They had assembled on Saturday, December 6th, 1941. Almost immediately, they found themselves busier yet. At 7 a.m. Hawaiian time, on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, near Kahuku Point, at the northernmost reach of the island of Oahu, two U.S. Army privates, in the process of shutting down the Opana Mobile Radar Station, an aircraft reconnaissance unit which they had manned since 4 a.m., noticed an unusual disturbance on their oscilloscope screen. They checked and confirmed no malfunction and decided the large merged blur of light must be a flight of some sort. Their plotting board indicated a bearing out of the northeast at a distance of 132 miles. More than 50 planes appeared to be involved. One of the men called the information center at Fort Shafter, at the other end of the island, where radar and visual reconnaissance reports were combined on a tabletop map. The lieutenant who took the phone heard the radar operator call the sightings the biggest he had ever seen. The operator did not, however, report his estimate of their number. Both the Army and the Navy had been warned of imminent danger of Japanese attack. The Japanese had convinced themselves that dominance over East Asia was vital to their survival. The American reaction of militant Japanese expansion into Manchuria and China As many as 200,000 men, women, and children were brutally slaughtered by the Japanese army in Shanghai in 1937, had been to embargo war materials and freeze Japanese assets in the United States. Aviation fuel, steel, and scrap iron went on the embargo list in September 1940, when the Japanese moved into French Indochina with the timid approval of Vichy France. After that, the Japanese estimated they could survive no more than 18 months without access to Asian oil and iron ore. For some time, they had prepared for war while continuing to negotiate. Now, negotiations had collapsed. Lieutenant General Walter C. Short, commander of the Army's Hawaiian Department, received a coded message on November 27th, signed in the name of the Chief of Staff, George Marshall, that read in part, "Negotiations with Japan appear to be terminated to all practical purposes, with only the barest possibility that the Japanese government might come back and offer to continue. Japanese future action unpredictable, but hostile action possible at any moment. If hostilities cannot, repeat, cannot be avoided, the United States desires that Japan commit the first overt act. Measures should be carried out so as not, repeat, not, to alarm civil population or disclose intent." Short had at option three levels of alert, escalating from a defense against sabotage, espionage, and subversive activities without any threat from the outside, to full defense against an all-out attack. He thought it obvious that the War Department message was written basically for General MacArthur in the Philippines, and chose the limited sabotage defense, alert number one. Admiral Husband E. Kimmel, commander-in-chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, which was based at Pearl Harbor, west of Honolulu, on the southern coast of Oahu, received a similar, but even more pointed message from the Navy Department a few hours later. "This dispatch is to be considered a war warning. Negotiations with Japan, looking toward stabilization of conditions in the Pacific, have ceased, and an aggressive move by Japan is expected within the next few days. The number and equipment of Japanese troops and the organization of naval task forces indicates an amphibious expedition against either the Philippines, Thai, or Kra Peninsula, or possibly Borneo. Execute an appropriate defensive deployment preparatory to carrying out the tasks assigned." Kimmel noted the references to other theaters of potential conflict. When he and Short exchanged messages, he noted the more cautious phrasing of the Army warning. Appropriate defensive deployment meant, he thought, full security measures for ships at sea. A surprise submarine attack seemed possible, and he ordered the depth bombing of any submarines discovered in the waters around Oahu. The Army lieutenant who took the Opana radar call therefore had no expectation of danger. He looked for a routine explanation of the unusual report and found it. The Army paid radio station KGMB in Honolulu to play Hawaiian music throughout the night whenever it ferried aircraft to the islands, giving its navigators a signal to seek. The lieutenant had heard such music on the radio that morning on his way to the information center. He decided that the radar must be picking up a flight of B-17s. The heading plotted at Opanu was the usual direction of approach from California. "Well, don't worry about it," the lieutenant told the radar men. Pearl Harbor is a shallow compound basin sheltered inland through a narrow outer channel from the sea. A bulge of land, Pearl City, and a mid-basin island, Ford Island, canalize the main anchorage of the harbor into a loop of narrow inlets. In 1941, dry docks, oil storage tanks, and a submarine base occupied the harbor's irregular eastern shore. Seven battleships rode at anchor immediately southeast of Ford Island that Sunday morning. Nevada anchored alone. Arizona inboard of the repair ship Vestal. Tennessee inboard of West Virginia. Maryland inboard of Oklahoma. California alone. An eighth battleship, Pennsylvania, wedged naked in dry dock nearby. Lieutenant Commander Mitsuo Fuchida of the Japanese Imperial Navy, 39 years old, who wore a red shirt to disguise from his men any blood he might shed, and a white hachimaki tied around his flight helmet, brushed with the calligraphic characters for certain victory, called out "Tora, Tora, Tora" at 0753 hours, as his pilot banked around Barber's Point, southwest of Pearl. Tiger, three times invoked, to announce to the listening Japanese Navy that his first wave of 183 planes had achieved complete surprise. The 43 fighters, 49 high-level bombers, 51 dive bombers, and 40 torpedo planes he commanded had flown from six carriers holding station 200 miles to the north, carriers formidably escorted by battleships, heavy cruisers, destroyers, and submarines that had left Hitokapu Bay on the northern Japanese island of Itorofu on November 25th and sailed blacked out in radio silence across the stormy but empty northern Pacific for almost 2 weeks to achieve this stunning rendezvous. The torpedo bombers divided into groups of twos and threes and dived. The air crews had prepared themselves to ram the battleships if necessary, but nothing restrained their attack. At 0758, the Ford Island Command Center radioed its frantic message to the world. Air raid Pearl Harbor. This is not drill. Admiral Kimmel saw the attack begin from a neighbor's lawn. In utter disbelief and completely stunned, the neighbor remembers, as white as the uniform he wore. Torpedoes struck a light cruiser and a target ship, a mine layer, another light cruiser, then the battleships. Arizona lifted out of the water. West Virginia washed by a huge waterspout. Oklahoma hit by three torpedoes, one after another, and immediately listing steeply to port. The bottom blown out of Arizona. Three torpedoes into California, two more into West Virginia, a fourth into Oklahoma that bounced the big ship and rolled it over bottom up. Arizona taking a bomb that detonated its forward explosive stores, ripped the ship apart, killed at least 1,000 men, and blew high into the air a grisly rain of bodies, hands, legs, and heads. A torpedo tearing out Nevada's port bow. Thick, black smoke rolled up to foul the blue Hawaiian morning, and in the water, burning, screaming men attempted to swim through a dense scum of burning oil. Japanese fighters and bombers destroyed aircraft on the ground and strafed soldiers and Marines pouring out of barracks at Hickam Field and Ewa Field and Wheeler. An hour later, a second wave of 167 more attack aircraft deployed to further destruction. The two raids accounted for eight battleships, three light cruisers, three destroyers, and four other ships sunk, capsized, or damaged, and 292 aircraft damaged or wrecked, including 117 bombers. And 2,403 Americans, military and civilian, killed. 1,178 wounded in unprovoked assaults that lasted only minutes. The following afternoon, Franklin Roosevelt, addressing Congress in joint session, requested and won a declaration of war against not only Japan, but Germany and Italy as well. The man who conceived and planned the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto, Commander-in-Chief of the Japanese Combined Fleet, had few illusions about the ultimate success of a war against the United States. He had studied at Harvard and served as a naval attaché in Washington and knew America's strength. But if war had to come, he meant to give a fatal blow to the enemy fleet when it was least expected, at the outset. By that act, he hoped he could win his country 6 months to a year, during which it might establish its Greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere and dig in. The torpedoes had been a challenge. Pearl Harbor was only 40 feet deep. Torpedoes dropped from planes routinely sank 70 feet or more before bobbing up to attack depth. The Japanese had to reduce that plunge significantly or bury their weapons in the Pearl mud. They found, in repeated experiments, that they could sometimes manage a shallower drop by flying only 40 feet above the water and holding down their airspeed. The maneuver demanded skilled flying. But further improvement required torpedo redesign, largely by trial and error. As late as mid-October, Fuchida's flyers were still managing no better than 60-foot plunges, still far too deep. A new stabilizer fin, originally designed for aerial stability, saved the mission. Tested during September, it consistently held the torpedo to less than 40 feet and steadied it as well. But the pilot still needed aiming practice. Only 30 of the modified weapons could be promised by October 15th, another 50 by the end of the month, and the last 100 on November 30th, after the task force was scheduled to sail. The manufacturer did better, realizing the weapons were vital to a secret program of unprecedented importance. Manager Yukito Fukuda bent company rules, drove his lathe and assembly crews overtime, and delivered the last of the 180 specially modified torpedoes by November 17th. Mitsubishi Munitions contributed decisively to the success of the first massive surprise blow of the Pacific War by the patriotic effort of its torpedo factory on Kyushu, the southernmost Japanese island, 3 miles up the Urakami River from the bay in the old port city of Nagasaki. 13. The New World. Enrico Fermi's team at Columbia University had been hard at work through 1941 while the government deliberated. Fermi, Leo Szilard, Herbert Anderson, and the young physicists who had joined them may never have known how close they came to orphanhood. The isolation of plutonium at Berkeley added a potential military application to their reasons for pursuing a slow neutron chain reaction in uranium and graphite. But given the necessary resources, Fermi, at least, would certainly have pursued the chain reaction anyway as a physical experiment of fundamental and historic worth. He had missed discovering fission by the thickness of a sheet of aluminum foil. He would not willingly leave to someone else the demonstration of atomic energy's first sustained release. Thanks largely to Arthur Compton, his work found continued support, which may help explain why he admired the pious Woosterite's intelligence so extravagantly. Szilard had finally gone on the Columbia payroll on November 1st, 1940, when the $40,000 National Defense Research Committee contract came through for physical constant measurements. To help Fermi with the friction the two men generated when they worked side by side, Szilard undertook to apply his special talent for enlightened cajolery to the problem of procuring supplies of purified uranium and graphite. The record is thick with his correspondence with American graphite manufacturers, dismayed to discover that what they thought were the purest of materials were in fact hopelessly contaminated, usually with traces of boron. The cross-section for neutron absorption of that light, ubiquitous silicon-like element, number 5 on the periodic table, was tremendous and poisonous. Szilard at that time took extremely decisive and strong steps to try to organize the early phases of production of pure materials, says Fermi. He did a marvelous job, which later on was taken over by a more powerful organization than was Szilard himself. Although, to match Szilard, it takes a few able-bodied customers. In August and September, the Columbia team prepared to assemble the largest uranium graphite lattice yet devised. A slow neutron chain reaction in natural uranium, like its fast neutron counterpart, U-235, requires a critical mass, a volume of uranium and moderator sufficient to sustain neutron multiplication despite the inevitable loss of neutrons from its outer surface. No one yet knew the specifications of that critical volume, but it was obviously vast, on the order of some hundreds of tons. One way to create a self-sustaining chain reaction might be simply to continue stacking uranium and graphite together. But so crude an experiment, if it worked at all, would teach the experimenter very little about controlling the resulting reaction, and might culminate in a disastrous and lethal runaway. Fermi proposed to approach the problem by the more circumspect route of a series of subcritical experiments designed to determine the necessary quantities and arrangements and to establish methods of control. As always, he built directly on previous experience. He and Anderson had calculated the absorption cross-section of carbon by measuring the diffusion of neutrons from a neutron source up a column of graphite. The new experiments would enlarge that column to take advantage of the increased stocks of graphite available and to make room for regularly spaced inclusions of uranium oxide. Simplicity itself, but in physical form, a thick, black, grimy, slippery mass of some 30 tons of extruded bars of graphite, confining 8 tons of oxide. Fermi named the structure a pile. Much of the standard nomenclature in nuclear science was developed at this time, Segre writes. I thought for a while that this term was used to refer to a source of nuclear energy in analogy with Volta's use of the Italian term pila to denote his own great invention of a source of electrical energy, that is, the voltaic battery. I was disillusioned by Fermi himself, who told me that he simply used the common English word pile as synonymous with heap. The Italian laureate was continuing to master the plain song of American speech. The exponential pile Fermi proposed to build, so-called because an exponent entered into the calculation of its relationship to a full-scale reactor, would be too big for any of the laboratories in Pupin. He sought larger quarters. We went to Dean Pegram, who was then the man who could carry out magic around the university, and we explained to him that we needed a big room. And when we say big, we meant a really big room. Perhaps he made a crack about a church not being the most suited place for a physics laboratory, but I think a church would have been just precisely what we wanted. Well, he scouted around the campus, and we went with him to dark corridors and under various heating pipes and so on to visit possible sites for this experiment, and eventually a big room, not a church, but something that might have been compared in size with a church, was discovered in Skemmerhorn Hall. There, Fermi goes on, they began to build this structure that at that time looked again in order of magnitude larger than anything that we had seen before. It was a structure of graphite bricks, and spread through these graphite bricks in some sort of pattern were big cans, cubic cans, containing uranium oxide. The cans, 8 by 8 by 8 inches, 288 of them in all, were made of tinned iron sheet. Each could hold about 60 pounds of uranium oxide. Each cubic cell of the uranium graphite lattice, a can and its surrounding graphite, was 16 inches on a side. Spheres of uranium in an arrangement of spherical cells would have been more efficient. In these beginning experiments, with materials of doubtful purity, Fermi was pursuing order of magnitude estimates, a first rough mapping of new territory. This structure was chosen because of its constructional simplicity, the experimenters wrote afterward, since it could be assembled without cutting our graphite bricks of 4 inches by 4 inches by 12 inches. Although we did not expect that the structure would approach too closely the optimum proportions, we thought it desirable to obtain some preliminary information as soon as possible. Promising results might also win further NDRC support. "We were faced with a lot of hard and dirty work," Herbert Anderson recalls. "The black uranium oxide powder had to be heated to drive off undesired moisture and then packed hot in the containers and soldered shut. To get the required density, the filling was done on a shaking table. Our little group, which by that time included Bernard Feld, George Weil, and Walter Zinn, looked at the heavy task before us with little enthusiasm. It would be exhausting work." Then Pegram to the rescue in Fermi's telling. "We were reasonably strong, but I mean, we were, after all, thinkers. So Dean Pegram again looked around and said That seems to be a job a little beyond your feeble strength. But there is a football squad at Columbia that contains a dozen or so of very husky boys who take jobs by the hour just to carry them through college. Why don't you hire them? And it was a marvelous idea. It was really a pleasure for once to direct the work of these husky boys, canning uranium, just shoving it in, handling packs of 50 or 100 pounds with the same ease as another person would have handled 3 or 4 pounds. Fermi tried to do his share of the work, Anderson adds. He donned a lab coat and pitched in to do his stint with the football men, but it was clear he was out of his class. The rest of us found a lot to keep us busy with measurements and calibrations that suddenly seemed to require exceptional care and precision. For his first exponential experiment, and the many similar experiments to come, Fermi defined a single fundamental magnitude for assessing the chain reaction, the reproduction factor K. K was the average number of secondary neutrons produced by one original neutron in a lattice of infinite size. In other words, if the original neutron had all the room in the world in which to drift on its way to encountering a uranium nucleus, one neutron in the zero generation would produce K neutrons in the first generation, K2 neutrons in the second generation, K3 in the third generation, and so on. If K was greater than 1, the series would diverge, the chain reaction would go, in which case the production of neutrons is infinite. If K was less than 1, the series would eventually converge to 0, the chain reaction would die out. K would depend on the quantity and quality of materials used in the pile and the efficiency of their arrangement. The cubical lattice that the Columbia football squad stacked in Skemmerhorn Hall in September 1941 extrapolated to a disappointing first K of 0.87. Now, that is by 0.13 less than 1, Fermi comments, 13% less than the minimum necessary to make a chain reaction go. And it was bad. However, at the moment, we had a firm point to start from, and we had essentially to see whether we could squeeze the extra 0.13, or preferably a little bit more. The cans were made of iron, and iron absorbs neutrons. So out go the cans. Cubes of uranium were less efficient than spheres. Next time, the Columbia group would press the oxide into small, rounded lumps. The materials were impure, so now what do these impurities do? Clearly, they can do only harm. Maybe they make harm to the tune of 13%. Szilard would continue his quest for materials of higher purity. There was some considerable gain to be made there. Well, concludes Fermi, this brings us to Pearl Harbor. Arthur Compton had less than 2 weeks to throw together a program between his discussion with Vannevar Bush and James Bryant Conant at the Cosmos Club luncheon on December 6th, and the first meeting, on December 18th, of the new leaders of what was now to be called the S1 program, S1 for Section 1 of the Office of Scientific Research and Development. Conant would administer S1, but the National Defense Research Committee was no longer directly involved. The bomb program had advanced from research into development. On December 18th, Conant notes in the secret history of the project he wrote in 1943, the atmosphere was charged with excitement. The country had been at war 9 days. An expansion of the S1 program was now an accomplished matter. Enthusiasm and optimism reigned. Compton offered his program to Bush, Conant, and Briggs the next day, and followed up on December 20th with a memorandum. The projects that had come under his authority were scattered across the country at Columbia, Princeton, Chicago, and Berkeley. For the time being, he proposed leaving them there. With the arrival of war, not to breathe a word of the mysteries they were exploring, the project leaders had adopted an informal code. Plutonium was copper, U-235, magnesium, uranium generically in the nonsensical British coinage tube alloy. On the basis of the present data, Compton wrote, optimism reigning, it appears that explosive units of copper need be only half the size of those using magnesium, and that premature explosions can be ruled out. Because of the difficulty of engineering a remotely controlled chemical plant to extract plutonium, however, he thought that the production of useful quantities of copper will take longer than the production of magnesium. For a timetable, he offered knowledge of conditions for chain reaction by June 1, 1942, production of chain reaction by October 1, 1942. Pilot plant for using reaction for copper production, October 1, 1943. Copper in usable quantities by December 31, 1944. His schedule was designed to show that plutonium might be produced in time to influence the outcome of the war, the standard which Conant was insisting upon after Pearl Harbor even more vehemently than before. But the uranium graphite work had not yet won even Compton's full confidence. If graphite proved impractical, and copper production had to wait for heavy water, of which Harold Urey was urging the extraction at an existing plant in Canada, Compton's schedule would slip by from 6 months to 18 months, and that might be too late to make a difference. For the next 6 months, Compton estimated, the pile studies at Columbia, Princeton, and Chicago would cost $590,000 for materials and $618,000 for salaries and support. This figure seemed big to me, he remembers modestly, accustomed as I was to work on research that needed not more than a few thousand dollars per year. He had met with Pegram and Fermi to prepare this part of his proposal and concluded that when metallic uranium became available, the project should be concentrated at Columbia. Over Christmas and through the first weeks of January, it fell to Herbert Anderson, the native son, to find a building in the New York City area large enough to house a full-scale chain-reacting pile. Not to be outdone in the matter of informal codes, the Columbia team had named that culmination the egg-boiling experiment. Anderson stumped the wintry burrows and turned up 7 likely locations for boiling uranium eggs. He proposed them to Szilard on January 21st. They included a polo ground structure, an aircraft hangar on Long Island that belonged to Curtis Wright, and the hangar Goodyear used to house its blimps. But as Compton reviewed the work of the several groups that had come under his authority, bringing their leaders together in Chicago 3 times during January, their disagreements and duplications made it obvious that all the developmental work on the chain reaction and on plutonium chemistry should be combined at one location. Pegram offered Columbia. They considered Princeton and Berkeley and industrial laboratories in Cleveland and Pittsburgh. Compton offered Chicago. No one wanted to move. The third meeting of the new year, on Saturday, January 24th, Compton conducted from his sickbed in one of the sparsely finished spare bedrooms on the 3rd floor of his large University Avenue house. He had the flu. Risking infection, Szilard attended, Ernest Lawrence, Luis Alvarez, Lawrence and Alvarez sitting together on the next bed, and several other men. Each was arguing the merits of his own location, Compton writes, and every case was good. I presented the case for Chicago. He had already won the support of his university's administration. We will turn the university inside out if necessary to help win this war, its vice president had sworn. That was Compton's first argument. He knew the management and had its support. Second, more scientists were available to staff the operation in the Midwest than on the coasts, where faculties and graduate schools had been completely drained for other war work. Third, Chicago was conveniently and centrally located for travel to other sites. Which convinced no one. Szilard had 40 tons of graphite on hand at Columbia and a going concern. The arguments continued. Compton, who was notoriously indecisive, suffered their brunt as long as he could bear it. Finally, wearied to the point of exhaustion, but needing to make a firm decision, I told them that Chicago would be the project's location. Lawrence scoffed. You'll never get a chain reaction going here, he baited his fellow laureate. The whole tempo of the University of Chicago is too slow. "We'll have the chain reaction going here by the end of the year," Compton predicted. "I'll bet you $1,000 you won't." "I'll take you on that," Compton says, he answered. "And these men here are the witnesses."
"I'll cut the stakes to a 5-cent cigar,"
Lawrence hedged.
"Agreed," said Compton, who never smoked a cigar in his life.
After the crowd left, Compton shuffled wearily to his study and called Fermi. He agreed at once to make the move to Chicago, Compton writes. Fermi may have agreed, but he found the decision burdensome. He was preparing further experiment. His group was exactly the right size. He owned a pleasant house in a pleasant suburb. He and Laura had buried a cache of Nobel Prize money in a lead pipe under the concrete floor of their basement coal bin, against the possibility that as enemy aliens, their assets would be frozen. Laura Fermi had come to consider Leonia as our permanent home, she writes, and loathed the idea of moving again. She says her husband was unhappy to move. They, I did not know who they were, had decided to concentrate all that work, I did not know what it was, in Chicago, and to enlarge it greatly. Enrico grumbled. It was the work he had started at Columbia with a small group of physicists. There is much to be said for a small group. It can work quite efficiently. But the country was at war. Fermi traveled back and forth by train until the end of April, then camped in Chicago. Laura dug up their buried treasure and followed at the end of June. To Szilard, the day after the sickbed meeting, he had returned promptly to New York, Compton sent a respectful telegram. "Thank you for coming to present ably Columbia's situation. Now we need your help in organizing the metallurgical laboratory of OSRD in Chicago. Can you arrive here Wednesday morning with Fermi and Wigner to discuss details of moving and organization?" Unlike the radiation laboratory at MIT, the new metallurgical laboratory hardly disguised its purpose in its name. Who would imagine its goal was the transmutation of the elements to make baseball-sized explosive spheres of unearthly metal? Before Fermi and his team moved to Illinois, they built one more exponential pile, this one loaded with cylindrical lumps of pressed uranium oxide, 3 inches long and 3 inches in diameter, that weighed 4 pounds each, some 2,000 in all, set in blind holes drilled directly into graphite. A new recruit, a handsome, dark-haired young experimentalist named John Marshall, located a suitable press for the work in a junkyard in Jersey City and set it up on the 7th floor of Pupin. Walter Zinn designed stainless steel dyes, the powdered oxide bound together under pressure as medicinal tablets pressed from powder. Aspirin, for example, do. Fermi was concerned to free the pile as completely as possible of moisture to reduce neutron absorption. He had canned the oxide before. Now he decided to can the entire 9-foot graphite cube. "There are no ready-made cans of the needed size," Laura Fermi says dryly. "So Enrico ordered one. That," writes Albert Wattenberg, who joined the group in January, "required soldering together many strips of sheet metal. We were very fortunate in getting a sheet metal worker who made excellent solder joints. It was, however, quite a challenge to deal with him, since he could neither read nor speak English. We communicated with pictures, and somehow he did the job." Laura Fermi picks up the story. "To ensure proper assembly, they marked each section with a little figure of a man. If the can were put together as it should be, all men would stand on their feet, otherwise on their heads. The Columbia men preheated the oxide lumps to 480 degrees Fahrenheit before loading. They heated the contents of the room-sized can to the boiling point of water and pumped down a partial vacuum. Their heroic efforts reduced the pile's moisture to 0.03%. With the same relatively impure uranium and graphite they had used before, but with these improved conditions and arrangements, they measured K at the end of April at an encouraging 0.918. In Chicago, in the meantime, Samuel Allison had built a smaller 7-foot exponential pile and measured K for his arrangement at 0.94. The University of Chicago had long ago sacrificed football to scholarship. Compton took over the warren of disused rooms under the west stands of Stagg Field, which was conveniently located immediately north of the main campus, and made space available there to Allison. Below solid masonry facades set with Gothic windows and crenellated towers, the stands concealed ball courts as well as locker areas, the unheated room Allison had used for his experiment, 60 feet long, 30 feet wide, 26 feet high, and sunk half below street level, was a doubles squash court.
December 6, 1941, the day of the bomb program expansion, marked another tidal event. Soviet forces under General Georgi Zhukov counterattacked across a 200-mile front against the German army, congealed in snow and negative 35-degree Fahrenheit cold, only 30 miles outside Moscow.
Like the supreme military genius who had trod this road a century before him, Churchill writes, evoking Napoleon Bonaparte, Hitler now discovered what Russian winter meant. Zhukov's 100 divisions came as a bitter surprise. Well-fed, warmly clad, and fresh Siberians, a German general describes them, fully equipped for winter fighting. As the Wehrmacht troops were not, and armies that had advanced 500,000 miles to push within sight of the Kremlin stumbled back toward Germany, nearly en route. For the first time since Hitler began his conquests, Blitzkrieg had failed. The winter had fallen, Churchill writes. The long war was certain. Hitler relieved his army commander-in-chief of duty and appropriated that office to himself. By the end of March, his casualties in the east, counting not the sick, but only the wounded, numbered nearly 1.2 million men. It was clear in Berlin that the German economy had reached the limits of its expansion. Trade-offs must follow. The Minister of Munitions installed a rule similar to the rule upon which Conant was insisting in the United States, and the director of the Reich Military Research promulgated it to the physicists studying uranium. The work is making demands which can be justified in the current recruiting and raw materials crisis only if there is a certainty of getting some benefit from it in the near future. After considering the question, the War Office decided to reduce the priority of uranium research by assigning most of it to the Ministry of Education under Bernard Rust, the scientifically illiterate SS Obergruppenführer and former provincial schoolteacher who had refused to sanction Lise Meitner's emigration following the Anschluss. The academic physicists were happy to be out from under the army, but chagrined to be consigned to a backwater ministry run by a party hack. Rust delegated authority to the Reich Research Council. That organization was part of the Reich Bureau of Standards. The KWI physicists considered its physics section head, Abraham Esau, incompetent. In effect, the German uranium program had slipped in status to the level of the old U.S. Uranium Committee, and now had its briggs. The Research Council decided to appeal directly to the highest levels of the Reich for support. It organized an elaborate presentation and invited such dignitaries as Hermann Göring, Martin Bormann, Heinrich Himmler, Navy Commander-in-Chief Admiral Erich Raeder, Field Marshal Wilhelm Keitel, and Albert Speer, Hitler's admired patrician architect who was Minister of Armaments and War Production. Heisenberg, Hahn, Botha, Geiger, Clusius, and Hartek were scheduled to speak at the February 26th meeting, Rust presiding, and an experimental luncheon would be served, offering entrees prepared from frozen foods basted with synthetic shortening and bread made with soy flour. Unfortunately for the Council's ambitious plans, the secretary assigned to send out invitations enclosed the wrong lecture program. A secret scientific conference under the auspices of Army Ordnance had been scheduled at the Kaiser Wilhelm Society's Harnack House for the same day. Its program listed 25 highly technical scientific papers. That was the program the leaders of the Reich mistakenly received. Himmler regretted. He would be away from Berlin that day. Keitel was too busy at the moment. Raeder would send a representative. None of the leaders chose to attend. What Heisenberg had to say might have surprised them. He emphasized atomic energy for power, but also discussed military uses. Pure uranium-235 is thus seen to be an explosive of quite unimaginable force, he told his staff-level auditors. The Americans seem to be pursuing this line of research with particular urgency. Inside a uranium reactor, a new element is created, that is plutonium, which is in all probability as explosive as pure uranium-235, with the same colossal force. At the same time, at Harnack House, where Leo Szilard once lodged, bags packed, Army Ordnance was learning that it would suffice to bring together two lumps of this explosive, weighing a total of 10 to 100 kilograms, for it to detonate. Basic knowledge of one direct route to an atomic bomb, via plutonium, was at hand. What was lacking was money and materials. The February 26th meeting won over at least the Minister of Education. The first time large funds were available in Germany, Heisenberg recalled at the end of the war, was in the spring of 1942, after that meeting with Rust, when we convinced him that we had absolutely definite proof that it could be done. Heisenberg's large is relative to the modest funds that had been available before, however. Not Bernard Rust, but Albert Speer needed to be convinced of the military promise of atomic energy to swell the scale of funding anywhere near the billions of Reichsmarks that production of even 10 kilograms of U-235 or plutonium would require. Speer did not recall the February 26th invitation after the war. Atomic energy first came to his attention, he writes in his memoirs, at one of his regular private luncheons with General Friedrich Fromm, the commander of the Home Army. In the course of one of these meetings, at the end of April 1942, Fromm remarked that our only chance of winning the war lay in developing a weapon with totally new effects. He said he had contacts with a group of scientists who were on the track of a weapon which could annihilate whole cities. Fromm proposed that we pay a joint visit to these men. Speer also heard that spring from the president of the Kaiser Wilhelm Society, who complained of lack of support for uranium research. On May 6, 1942, I discussed this situation with Hitler and proposed that Göring be placed at the head of the Reich Research Council, thus emphasizing its importance. That shift to the obese Reichmarschall, who commanded the Luftwaffe and whom Hitler had designated to be his successor, carried only symbolic promotion. More crucial was a June 4th conference at Harnack House that Speer, Fromm, automobile and tank designer Ferdinand Porsche, and other military and industrial leaders attended. In February, Heisenberg had devoted most of his lecture to nuclear power. This time, he emphasized military prospects. The secretary of the Kaiser Wilhelm Society was surprised. The word bomb, which was used at this conference, was news not only to me, but for many others present, as I could see from their reaction. It was not news to Speer. When Heisenberg took questions from the floor, one of Speer's deputies asked how large a bomb capable of destroying a city would have to be. Heisenberg cupped his hands, as Fermi had done, sighting down Manhattan Island from Pupin Hall. "As large as a pineapple," he said. After the briefings, Speer questioned Heisenberg directly. How could nuclear physics be applied to the manufacture of atomic bombs? The German laureate seems to have shied from committing himself. His answer was by no means encouraging, Speer remembers. He declared, to be sure, that the scientific solution had already been found. But the technical prerequisites for production would take years to develop, 2 years at the earliest, even provided that the program was given maximum support. They were crippled by an absence of cyclotrons, Heisenberg said. Speer offered to build cyclotrons as large as or larger than those in the United States. Heisenberg demurred that German physicists lacked experience building large cyclotrons and would have to start small. Speer urged the scientists to inform me of the measures, the sums of money, and the materials they would need to further nuclear research. A few weeks later, they did. But their requests looked picayune to a Reich minister accustomed to dealing in billions of marks. They requested an appropriation of several hundred thousand marks and some small amounts of steel, nickel, and other priority metals. Rather put out by these modest requests in a matter of such crucial importance, I suggested that they take 1 or 2 million marks and correspondingly larger quantities of materials. But apparently, more could not be utilized for the present. And in any case, I had been given the impression that the atom bomb could no longer have any bearing on the course of the war. Speer saw Hitler regularly and duly reported the findings of the June conferences. Hitler had sometimes spoken to me about the possibility of an atom bomb, but the idea quite obviously strained his intellectual capacity. He was also unable to grasp the revolutionary nature of nuclear physics. In the 2,200 recorded points of my conferences with Hitler, nuclear fission comes up only once, and then is mentioned with extreme brevity. Hitler did sometimes comment on its prospects, but what I told him of my conferences with the physicists confirmed his view that there was not much profit in the matter. Actually, Professor Heisenberg had not given any final answer to my question whether a successful nuclear fission could be kept under control with absolute certainty, or might continue as a chain reaction. Hitler was plainly not delighted with the possibility that the Earth under his rule might be transformed into a glowing star. Occasionally, however, he joked that the scientists, in their unworldly urge to lay bare all the secrets under heaven, might someday set the globe on fire. But undoubtedly, a good deal of time would pass before that came about, Hitler said. He would certainly not live to see it. Following that, according to Speer, on the suggestion of the nuclear physicists, we scuttled the project to develop an atom bomb. After I had again queried them about deadlines and been told that we could not count on anything for 3 or 4 years. Work on what Speer calls an energy-producing uranium motor for propelling machinery, the heavy water pile, would continue. In the upshot, Heisenberg wrote in Nature in 1947, summarizing the war years, German physicists were spared the decision as to whether or not they should aim at producing atomic bombs. The circumstances shaping policy in the critical year of 1942 guided their work automatically toward the problem of the utilization of nuclear energy in prime movers. But the Allies had not yet been informed. We may be engaged in a race toward realization, Vannevar Bush wrote Franklin Roosevelt on March 9, 1942. But if so, I have no indication of the status of the enemy program and have taken no definite steps toward finding out. Why Bush was not more curious remains a mystery. Conant, Lawrence, and Compton, not to mention the émigrés, fretted continually about the possibility of a German bomb. It was their primary reason for urging an American bomb. It was not Bush's or Roosevelt's. To them, the bomb offered offensive advantage first of all. But the two leaders were alert to the German danger and surprisingly indifferent to assessing it. The report that accompanied Bush's letter stated that 5 to 10 pounds of active material would be fairly certain to explode with a force equivalent to 2,000 tons of TNT, up from 600 tons in the Third National Academy of Sciences report of the previous November 6th. It recommended building a centrifuge plant at a cost of $20 million, that could produce enough U-235 for one bomb a month, and estimated that such a plant could be completed by December 1943. A gaseous diffusion plant, its cost unspecified, might deliver by the end of 1944. An electromagnetic separation plant, Ernest Lawrence's project, won the most attention in the report. It might offer a shortcut, wrote Bush, and deliver fully practicable quantities of material by the summer of 1943, with a time saving of perhaps 6 months or even more. In summary, present opinion indicates that successful use is possible, and that this would be very important and might be determining in the war effort.
It is also true that if the enemy arrives at results first, it would be an exceedingly serious matter. The best estimate indicates completion in 1944, if every effort is made to expedite. Roosevelt responded 2 days later, "I think the whole thing should be pushed, not only in regard to development, but also with due regard to time. This is very much of the essence. Time, not money, was becoming the limiting factor in atomic bomb development." A meeting on May 23rd brought all the program leaders together with Conan to decide which of several methods of making a bomb should be moved on to the pilot plant and industrial engineering stages. The centrifuge, gaseous barrier diffusion, electromagnetic, and graphite or heavy water plutonium pile approaches all looked equally promising. Given wartime scarcities and budget priorities, which should be advanced? Conant used an arms race argument to identify the point of decision. While all five methods now appear to be about equally promising, clearly the time of production of a dozen bombs by the five routes will certainly not be the same, but might vary by 6 months or a year because of unforeseen delays. Therefore, if one discards one or two or three of the methods now, one may be betting on the slower horse unconsciously. To my mind, the decision as to how all out the effort should be might well turn on the military appraisal of what would occur if either side had a dozen or two bombs before the other. To that point, Conant reviewed the evidence for a German bomb program, including new indications of espionage activity, information from the British that the Germans had a ton of heavy water, Peter Debye's report when he arrived in the United States 18 months earlier that his colleagues at the KWI were hard at work, and the recently intercepted instruction to their agents in this country that shows they are interested in what we are doing. Conant thought this last evidence the best. If they are hard at work, they cannot be far behind since they started in 1939 with the same initial facts as the British and ourselves. There are still plenty of competent scientists left in Germany. They may be ahead of us by as much as a year, but hardly more. If time, not money, was the crucial issue, in Conant's words, if the possession of the new weapon in sufficient quantities would be a determining factor in the war, then 3 months' delay might be fatal. It followed that all five methods should be pushed at once, even though to embark on this Napoleonic approach to the problem would require the commitment of perhaps $500 million and quite a mess of machinery. Glenn Seaborg arrived in Chicago aboard the streamliner City of San Francisco at 9:30 a.m. Sunday, April 19, 1942, his 30th birthday. As he left the station, he noticed first that Chicago was cold compared to Berkeley, 40 degrees that spring morning. Then headlines at a newsstand caught him up on the developing Pacific War. The Japanese reported American aircraft had bombed Tokyo and three other Honshu cities, a surprise attack that neither Southwest Pacific Commander General Douglas MacArthur nor Washington acknowledged. It was Jimmy Doolittle's morale raid of 16 B-25 bombers launched one way across Japan to landing fields in China from the U.S. aircraft carrier Hornet. "This day marks a transition point in my life," Seaborg writes in his carefully documented diary-style memoir. "For tomorrow, I will take on the added responsibility of the 94 chemistry group at the Metallurgical Laboratory on the University of Chicago campus, the central component of the metallurgical project. Transmuting U-238 to plutonium in a chain-reacting pile was one thing. Extracting the plutonium from the uranium, quite another. The massive production piles that Compton's people were already beginning to plan would create the new element at a maximum concentration in the uranium of about 250 parts per million, a volume uniformly dispersed through each 2 tons of mingled uranium and highly radioactive fission products, equal to the volume of one U.S. dime. Seaborg's work was somehow to pull that dime's worth out.
He had made a good beginning at Berkeley, exploring plutonium's unusual chemistry. Oxidizing agents are chemicals that strip electrons from the outer shells of atoms. Reducing agents, conversely, add electrons to the outer shells of atoms. Plutonium, it seemed, precipitated differently when it was treated with oxidizing agents than when it was treated with reducing agents. In a +4 oxidation state, the Berkeley team had found the man-made element could be precipitated out of solution using a rare earth compound such as lanthanum fluoride as a carrier. Oxidize the same plutonium to a +6 oxidation state, and the precipitation no longer worked. The carrier crystallized, but the plutonium remained behind in solution. That gave Seaborg a basic approach to extraction. We conceived the principle of the oxidation-reduction cycle. This principle applied to any process involving the use of a substance which carried plutonium in one of its oxidation states but not in another. For example, a carrier could be used to carry plutonium in one oxidation state and thus to separate it from uranium and the fission products. Then, the carrier and the plutonium, now solid crystals, could be dissolved. The oxidation state of the plutonium changed, and the carrier reprecipitated, leaving the plutonium in solution. The oxidation state of the plutonium could again be changed, and the cycles repeated. With this type of procedure, only a contaminating element having a chemistry nearly identical with the plutonium itself would fail to separate if a large number of oxidation-reduction cycles were employed. A 2-day chemistry conference began on Wednesday, April 23rd, with Eugene Wigner, Harold Urey, Princeton theoretician John A. Wheeler, and a number of chemists already assigned to the Met lab on hand. The scientists discuss 7 possible ways to extract plutonium from irradiated uranium. They favored 4 that seemed particularly adaptable to remote control, not including precipitation. Seaborg, the new man, disagreed. "I, however, express confidence in the use of precipitation." They would nevertheless investigate all 7 methods proposed. That would require the full-time work of 40 men. One of Seaborg's jobs for months to come was recruiting. It worried him. "Sometimes I feel a little apprehensive about inviting people to give up their secure university positions and come to work at the Met Lab. They must gamble on the future of their careers, and how long they will be diverted from them, nobody knows." But if no one knew how long the work would last, most of them came to believe it transcendentally important. There is a statement of rather common currency around here and Berkeley that goes something like this: "No matter what you do with the rest of your life, nothing will be as important to the future of the world as your work on this project right now." So far, Seaborg had studied plutonium by following the characteristic radioactivity of minute amounts vastly diluted in carrier, the same tracer chemistry that Hahn, Fermi, and the Joliot-Curies had used. Chemical reactions often proceed differently at different dilutions, however. To prove that an extraction process would work at industrial scale, Seaborg knew he would have to demonstrate it at industrial scale concentrations. In peacetime, he might have waited until a pile large enough to transmute at least gram quantities of plutonium was built and operating. That normal procedure was a luxury the bomb program could not afford. Seaborg looked instead for a way to make more plutonium without a pile, and a way to work with concentrated solutions of the little he might make. The resources of the OSRD came to his aid in the first instance, his own imagination and ingenuity in the second. He commandeered the 45-inch cyclotron at Washington University.